Good morning, Chairman. Look, it's my 39th birthday today, and I'd like to thank you for moving the meeting to Melbourne and avoiding having to spend the day in Sin City, so thanks for that. Just a very quick preliminary question. Why is it taking so long to get Peter Costello on the team?
Mr. Costello is not on the team.
We had any discussions?
No further comment.
The ATO is announced they're having a number of audits on companies over tax havens. We're the biggest users of tax havens in Australia through our various funds. Is it a fair presumption to say that at least a part of the Macquarie Empire is one of those companies on the list currently being audited over tax havens?
We'll go to microphone number one after I answer this, and then you can have another go afterwards. But the answer to that is that, to the best of my knowledge, the answer is no, and Mr. Ward is confirming that. We, of course, did have a tax audit which received a degree of publicity related to, I think, our 1988 tax return, which was only concluded fairly recently. That was an outcome that we were very happy with and which revealed essentially no problems at all. So, and we're not on the, in any sense under tax audit at the moment.
Chairman, just picking up on the theme raised by Fred, I hadn't known we were 100 million down on this JREP investment in terms of the market value. I was going to ask a broader question, which is, what's the total disparity at the moment between the book value of our investments in the various listed funds and the market value? I asked a similar question at Babcock's a few weeks ago, and they said it was, I think, around 120 million underwater. And I guess specifically when I asked this, can you deal with the two big plays here? Our investment in Macquarie Infrastructure Group is currently valued by the market at 914 million. And our investment in Macquarie Airports is currently valued by the market at $966 million. Now, I'm presuming we've invested more, well over $1 billion in each. So how much are we underwater on the big two, MIG and MAP? What's the overall figure? And I'd be interested in hearing from the auditor on this question as to why we wouldn't have a mark-to-market approach when we come to rule off the accounts next time round. And in dealing with this question of MIG and MAP, we've got the situation at the moment where MIG closed last night at $2.35, yet our auditors and our directors claim it has a net tangible asset backing of $4.59. And in the case of Macquarie Airports, it was around $2.40 last night, and there's a claimed NTA of just over $5. So the situation there is that the market is valuing MIG and MAP collectively at $10 billion, and we're saying they're worth $20 billion. Now, this is unprecedented, and this is, I think, a huge vote of no confidence in the third-party managed infrastructure funds model. We've seen you take out Macquarie Capital. The stock was trading around $2.10. You've mopped them up at $3.40. I'm a shareholder in all of your funds, and I'd love to know whether you're contemplating similar moves, particularly in MIG and MAP. And when in dealing with this question of potential mop-ups of MIG and MAP, can you also address the issue of preemptive rights within the assets, within the toll road and the airport assets? I've heard some people say that you can't take out MIG or MAP because such a move would trigger punitive preemptive rights and potential loss of control over assets. So is that correct? Is it the case that you have to rule that out because of these preemptive rights within the individual assets in those two big funds? Thank you.
Nicholas?
Thank you for the question. I guess the first point to make, which I made in during our presentation, is that we don't report quarterly. So it is not the occasion now to actually look at write-downs. So write-downs are an issue that will be looked at in the September half and, of course, the March full year end. So it's not an issue for today's meeting. In terms of why we have the investments in these funds, it's important to recognise that this is a basic plank of our alignment with our investors. These are long-term holdings, and therefore we have to look at them on a long-term basis, not just on a mark-to-market basis. On the point about the third, on your point you raised about the management model, I think, to be fair, if you took a step back from the Macquarie-specific situation and looked at the market, you'll see that all assets in these categories, all companies in these categories, are suffering a similar valuation story in the market. So whether you're looking at internally managed property companies or infrastructure companies indeed, or externally managed property companies or infrastructure companies, I think you'll see that the fall in value is the same. So I don't think there is an argument to say that this is an issue of external management versus internal management. On the question of privatisation, this issue has been raised by many investors, both in the funds and in the group itself, and they've raised the issue of privatisation because they can see that the market for, in particular, infrastructure assets is very strong at the moment, and they can see that the value of the assets that our directors are ascribing to those assets are reflective of transactions happening in the marketplace. Now, similarly, from the REIT viewpoint, our directors are being directed by valuations coming through that are supporting the valuations that they're looking at. The difficulty, as I mentioned in the presentation, in the real estate market is there's not a lot of physical trading activity that can actually give people a high degree of confidence where the market sits at. So both in real estate and also in infrastructure, the issue that you raised about privatisation has been raised. It has been raised. And as you mentioned, that for one of our funds that was neither in infrastructure or real estate, a privatisation proposal is actually underway. So that was an initiative of the individual fund and the investors that they found who wanted to step up and invest in the fund. From where Macquarie is coming from, obviously we have a very strong unlisted business and we have a very strong listed business. Our role in terms of managing those assets is the same whether they're listed shareholders or unlisted shareholders. And we are very aware of where the investors are coming from in both those areas. So yes, it's an area that we've looked at extensively, we've talked about to a lot of people. But anything that we would be doing or thinking about, or that the funds would be thinking about in respect to their individual activities, of course, would be confidential until it's time for them to advise the market of it. So I'm afraid we don't engage in speculation about the potential of privatisation or other corporate moves with respect to these funds.
Chairman, I was a bit disappointed with Nicholas's comment that it's not the business of this meeting to have a discussion about carrying values and market values. Now, I asked at Babcock and I got a figure, $120 million. On the back of my envelope, I think the Macquarie equivalent figure is probably closer to $500 million, that we're looking at a $500 million write-down if we adopt a mark-to-market approach on our investments in various listed funds. Now, Nicholas has put out a press release saying, quote, it will be increasingly challenging to match last year's net profit of $1.8 billion. Now, the reason it will be increasingly challenging and the huge swing factor in the whole calculation of the profit is going to be the market or the book valuation of the carrying value of our assets. So I'd like to try again, and this time I'd like to bring in the Chairman of the Audit Committee, Catherine Livingstone, and I'd like to bring in the auditor himself, Ian Hammond, to try and understand how you're going to frame the profit when we get to the end of the full year at September 30. Are we going to take a mark-to-market approach? And how much would that hit be if we took the approach today? Because it's going to decimate, it's going to hit our profit by hundreds of millions of dollars. If we do it, that then flows into the bonus pool, the remuneration policies, that affects dividends, that affects everything. So I think it's absolutely unreasonable for Nicholas to suggest we shouldn't be having a discussion about this. Just take MAP and MIG as an example. You are looking at $2 billion of extra value if you can get MAP and MIG back to the valuations that PwC, which audits MAP, MIG, Macquarie and everything else, claims they are worth. So clearly, before we get the balance date, the biggest and most important thing for this board to be dealing with and for the management, which is so driven by remuneration and bonus pool, is to claim back some of that $2 billion of missing value in MIG and MAP. So I'm presuming that's going to be occupying management's time over the next 3 or 4 months to get that up so we don't have to book the loss on MIG, MAP and everything else. So Catherine, can you please tell us, will there be a mark-to-market approach, and can someone tell us what the current figure is? And Ian Hammond, I'd also like to hear from him because I'm worried about Nicholas. Nicholas created this model. Nicholas is emotionally in love with this model. If Nicholas had his way, and we're seeing it today, he's pretending the model is not dead. A lot of people are saying the model is dead. Nicholas created it. He doesn't want to admit there's a problem. That is where the independent directors and the auditor come in and take control. So we need to hear from Catherine and Ian Hammond on this vital question, which will be the biggest factor in what profit we report for the full year, for the half year to September 30. Thanks.
We can do that in a minute, but first of all, I'd like to ask Nicholas to clarify what he was saying before.
Sure. Thanks for that, and thanks for the question again, Stephen. Just coming back, as maybe I wasn't clear in what I was saying. I was saying that we don't produce accounts on a quarterly basis, so we don't actually look at the issues of write-down of the value of investments at this time. That is an issue, as you rightly say, for the directors, for the audit committee, after the September half year and then after the March half year. In terms of the quantification of that of those amounts, these are public. They're public. Everybody, our shareholding is public, and the prices are public. Greg advises me that as of today, I think, or yesterday,
closed yesterday.
In terms of the REITs, it's a $56 million deficit. In terms of MIG, it'd be $110 deficit. In terms of the JREP, we talked about before, it would be a $70 million deficit. There'd be no deficit for MAP. So they're the deficits we're looking at on a daily basis, and of course they will move up and down with the market on a regular basis. The issue in terms of what the directors and the audit committee will look at after September, after March, will not necessarily be a simple mark-to-market basis, because these investments are long-term investments. And so the issue that people turn their mind to at that time is whether there has been a sustained loss of value in terms of the in terms of these assets. And as I mentioned earlier, to look at that, it's a question of actually looking at what's happening in the underlying infrastructure market at that time. We could tell you what's happening now, and as you know, it's very positive in the underlying infrastructure market. What's happening in the underlying REIT market at the moment? As I said, that's more difficult because we aren't seeing the volumes of property transactions around the globe that we would normally expect to see. So there's some of the issues that the audit committee and the auditors will be looking at after the September and after the March results. In terms of your statement that this will be the single biggest issue affecting Macquarie as of year end, I mean, I frankly would be surprised it could be, because we don't know where the markets will be, both physically and from a listed side at that stage. But adding these numbers up here, we're looking at about $250 million, I think, after profit share. That's the gross number. That's even if we were going to go down that path, as we mentioned, JREP, we don't think is particularly reflective of a market, given only 20% of it trades. So if I can finish. So if you look at the REITs and MIG together, it's about 160, 170 on today's value. In terms of the bottom line impact of that, broadly speaking, you'd expect it to be a third in terms of magnitude and in terms of the final outcome. So that's the position. as to where we are today, but of course it will continue to develop as the year develops.
I mean, the test that has to be satisfied, which I'm sure both Catherine and Ian would attest to, is whether or not, in the opinion of the board and the auditors, there has been impairment. And if you take a sort of typical infrastructure situation, we're being outbid on transactions that we're interested in winning. And if you apply the same valuation methodology to the underlying assets in MIG, it gives you a number well in excess of the current quoted share price. In those circumstances, there is at least a substantial case for not making a write-down if the underlying assets are worth substantially more than what they're in our books at. So the issue of impairment is a complex issue, and it's not just a case of looking up in the newspaper what the current value is. In fact, I believe one of the reasons that unlisted funds are very popular at the moment is that a more fundamental methodology for valuation is adopted for them, and they don't have to go through writing up, writing down every quarter or half year or year or whatever, when the underlying value of the underlying assets hasn't changed. So next time around, if you want to press, we can do that, but for the moment, that's the answer on the question.
Thanks, Nicholas, for filling in some of the bigger numbers on those market value issues. Look, I'm a keen investor in every listed Macquarie vehicle in Australia, so I've felt plenty of pain on the Macquarie Fortress and Macquarie DDR, which are both now sub-20-cent shares, and I suspect, though, in terms of write-downs, where Macquarie's got a big stake, the only other material one is probably Macquarie Communications Infrastructure Group, so can Greg pass forward the figure on that? We're at $250 million gross. I'm looking for a macro figure for all our listed funds. Just put all those figures together, including the rats and mice. Now, Nicholas said that he didn't think that it would be a material factor on the profit in terms of the swing value of the swing rate on these valuations in the listed funds. I was at the Macquarie Airport's AGM a few weeks ago, where Chairman Max Moore-Wilton, I thought quite brazenly, declared that he felt that he could sell Sydney Airport for significantly more than book value. Now, book value is $11.5 billion. And Nicholas drove the deal, brilliant, bought it for 5.6. We now have it on the books. Macquarie Airport's at 11.5. It's carrying about $500 million of debt. So I'd simply say to you, and you've made a number of comments today, that the infrastructure market is very strong. And if the chairman of Macquarie Airport thinks we can sell it for more than $12 billion, my comment is, go ahead and make our day. Sell Sydney Airport for $12 billion, do a capital return, and I promise you, Nicholas, you'll be booking hundreds of millions of dollars of extra profit, and you won't be talking about it being increasingly difficult to match last year's $1.8 billion. If you sell Sydney Airport for $12 billion before September 30 and return the capital, we will make hundreds of millions of dollars, and you'll make a great profit, and everyone else will get a bigger bonus. So this is where I'm simply saying, I'm asking about the integrity of the valuation. If you really think that, if the market says MAP's worth $250 and you really believe Sydney Airport's worth $12 billion, I want to hear you both say today, I think it's worth more than book value, like the chairman of Macquarie Airports, and if that's the case, why aren't you selling it?
Well, thank you, Stephen, for that excellent idea. We'll take away and do some work on that. In terms of the impact of the listed funds, just filling out the story, Greg advises me that MCG, actually, there is no loss below book value with respect to MCG. So the value we have of MCG versus market means that we wouldn't even be contemplating any suggestion of a write-down. Just the other point in terms of whether these write-downs would be material or not. If I did say material, they would be immaterial is probably not what I meant. What I was, I think, responding to you was your suggestion that this would be the single biggest item to impact upon our results for the year. And just the obvious point, obviously, we have a very diverse business operating all around the world, and this would be, if we were looking at any form of write-down, it could have an impact. But the point I was making is it wouldn't be the biggest impact on our results for the year. much bigger impact will come from issues like how the global equity markets are trading, how the global debt markets are trading for the rest of the year.
Chairman, I was interested in your comments about the Pennsylvania Turnpike. MIG's trading at 235, the directors claim it's worth 459, and you're saying you're underdoing it on book value. So,
yeah.
I mean, I can only say that I think this gets to the bigger issue of the model and the structure, that there is such a valuation discount being applied by the public markets that clearly it's not sustainable. We have to do something about it. Now, for mine, the bell was tolled when that risk metrics report came out a few months ago, which was launching a major attack on the Macquarie model from a governance point of view, saying that the Bermuda registration and the huge fees that get ripped out and the control that Macquarie has, the lack of control that the independent directors have, the non-disclosure of the management contracts, which does happen in the US when funds are listed but doesn't happen here. You've all received waivers from the stock exchange not to disclose your management contracts. And the smell around Babcock in particular and all these funds having too much debt is caused a capital strike. And there's now a massive discount being applied to MIG and MAP, and the market's not discriminating. MAP and MIG have got cash at the fund level, $10 billion of debt plus at the asset level, but cash at the fund level. And it's not being valued accordingly. So I guess my question is, I know Nicholas pioneered the model and wants to believe in it, but I actually think it's dead and we need to do something about it. And the first question would be, why don't we internalise the management of MIG and MAP? Because I think you would get a substantial valuation uplift. And if you consider the fact that we've got $1.9 billion today's market value invested in those two funds, if we came out and said, we've seen the light, we accept the market's conclusions, we are going to internalise the management of MIG and MAP, have an independent chairman, a majority of independent directors, and have a conventional investment banking advisory relationship with these funds, you'd probably get hundreds of millions of dollars of value created in the uplift in your stake, which is the largest stake of any shareholder in both funds. So I guess I'm asking you to be proactive and to examine doing it yourself voluntarily. And the second part of the question is, how secure are you from someone doing it for you? In other words, your shareholders revolting and saying, we're sick of you doing nothing about a 50% valuation discount. We are going to move to sack the manager and have you removed. So if that was to happen, what sort of protection do we have? What sort of termination payments or fees are we guaranteed to receive? Because as an investor in all these funds, I'm very unhappy with the lack of action in MIG and MAP and the lack of realisation that the world has changed and that there is a huge governance discount and there is a huge capital strike. So why are you sitting there and saying, that's not a dead parrot, when it is a dead parrot? Why aren't you actually doing something? Have you looked at internalisation? And if it comes to the crunch and you get turfed by your investors, what protections do you have to ensure there's a big compensation payment on the way out?
Thanks for the question, Stephen, and the idea. Importantly, as I mentioned before, when you look at the sector, the real estate sector or the infrastructure sector, I think it's a bit unfair to say this is an issue about management being internalised or externalised. I think if you look across the board, internalised structures have suffered as much as external management structures. So I think it's much more an issue of the market's appetite for the underlying nature of the investment, whether it's real estate or whether it's infrastructure. And real estate is obviously a global phenomena in terms of what's been happening there. In terms of infrastructure, to an extent that's a global issue as well. But of course we have another issue taking place, particularly in this market, again a global issue, but from an investor interest viewpoint, resources, as David illustrated earlier, is a much more interesting sector of the market to be attracting large flows of capital at the moment. Now, historically, we have been in these cycles before. We were in this cycle back in the late 90s when technology and growth was very, very popular then, and we saw our infrastructure funds actually underperforming at that time, because again, investors were looking for growth. Now similarly, investors are still looking for growth in the resources space, particularly in this country and more so globally. So I think it's a little bit unfair to characterise what we're seeing in the global real estate market and what we're seeing in the infrastructure market in particular here as being an issue about Macquarie and about external management. I think it is indeed a much bigger issue about the view of those underlying assets and the alternatives available for investors out there. So we are, as I mentioned before, we are conscious of these issues. We actually do look at suggestions like the ones you're making. They are made by other investors on a not infrequent basis, and we do discuss them and we do develop them. And obviously, if we thought there was benefit in them, if we thought there was merit in it from an invest for the investors on a long-term basis, we would certainly be investigating them very, very thoroughly.
Just to add to that, I think the evidence of what's happening in MCAG is evidence of that phenomenon. And the other issue is, as I mentioned earlier, the unlisted space is popular at the moment, but this is a cyclical phenomenon. I think the important thing to look at is not so much internalised, but unlisted versus listed, because there's no evidence we can see that the internalised model produces superior results to the externally managed model. But there is currently investor demand for unlisted vehicles rather than listed. And I mean, frankly, if the underlying assets continue to perform well, and that's not being recognised on a long-term basis, we would see it as our job to try and find a way to realise that value for the investors. I mean, but it's not something that you change your position on every 5 minutes. It's something that you only do when you're convinced that there is the cyclicality is not going to return and that it is in the best long-term interests of the investors in those funds. I mean, at the end of the day, we will live and die by the performance of our funds over the long term. We won't live and die by the performance of our funds every 5 minutes.
Chairman, I wanted to congratulate Macquarie Group for being awarded Investment Bank of the Year by the trade magazine Australian Banking and Finance last year. But then I recently discovered the magazine's owned by Nicholas. What's going on with a banker owning a banking magazine?
I don't believe Nicholas owned it at the time that he would, but I may be wrong.
So I'm happy to answer that, Stephen. I am a shareholder in the magazine. I have been a shareholder for a little bit of time, a year or two. My shareholding at the moment is about 25%. I mean, I have not and do not participate in any editorial policies of the magazine whatsoever. You're right, I am a shareholder. I own 25% of it at the moment, but I don't participate in editorial comment.
I did ask to hear from Mr. Hammer before, Chairman, so now might be an opportune time for his observations on the approach he will be taking on the question of mark to market when it comes to the book profit we announced for September 30. And a question I've raised with you before, I understand that the Macquarie Group is one of the two or three biggest fee-paying clients of PwC worldwide. It's tens of millions of dollars. They're auditing most of our funds, plus the headstock. Badcock adopts the governance high ground of having EY audit the headstock, and then usually PwC auditing most of their vehicles. Again, I've said before, I've got a problem with the fact that the chairman of the Badcock Audit Committee has an office at PwC, which is not a good look, but that's what they do. So my question is, I want him to respond on the question of the book values. And once again, why aren't we adopting a model of having a different audit firm for our listed funds as opposed to the headstock like Babcock does?
Ian, would you like... I mean, before I ask Mr. Hammond to comment, I should just point out that the Audit Committee is required to confirm the independence of PwC annually, And the policy of PwC as part of that assessment is for the partner who works on the headstock, the group, is a different partner, and the people involved in that audit are different people, and there is a requirement for the partner to be rotated every 5 years. But Ian, would you like to add any further, Mark?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Main, for your question. If I could just start by apologising for not standing up to address the shareholders. Unfortunately, I have a sporting injury and I'm on crutches, but thank you for your questions nonetheless. Can I answer the first question in relation to the carrying values of investments in the funds that you refer to? There is a general description of our audit approach and our audit work in the annual report, which is included on page 215. But in this context of my opinion there and explanation there, I would like to confirm to the meeting that in the course of the audit we do conduct procedures specifically looking at the carrying value of the investments. They're described in the financial statements as investments in associates. Without going into the technicalities of the accounting standard requirements, the accounting standard requirements are that these assets firstly need to be assessed if they're impaired, and secondly that they are carried at the higher of fair value, i.e. market value, and what's called value of in use. As the chairman has indicated, that requires management and the directors to assess the underlying value of those investments. As I've indicated in the course of our work, I could confirm that the financial statements that were prepared and presented by the directors at March do comply with those accounting standard requirements, and I can assure you that my partners will again be examining these issues at 30 September. Moving to your second question, in relation to independence. I can assure the meeting that there are no legal or professional restrictions which would prevent my firm undertaking audit work for both the funds and the bank and the group. As the chairman has indicated, there are other stakeholders, there are other independent boards of directors of those funds who are responsible for the audit appointments of those funds. Secondly, it is common practice in Australia that there is frequently the same firm auditing a group and the funds. In fact, that is the normal situation for all the other major banks in this country, the major listed retail banks. And let me assure shareholders that the scope of our work in conducting this audit is consistent with the size and the geographical diversity and the diversity of operations of this group, and we continue to maintain our independence in all situations. Thank you.
Just last issue on general business, Chairman. Asked this one before. Can you give us an update? We've waged a fairly expensive defamation battle against The Australian. My advice in the past has been it's not wise to pick a fight with Rupert Murdoch. We've bought ourselves a bucket load of bad publicity and front page stories in The Australian as a result. I know we didn't like what The Australian wrote about our involvement with the Beaconsfield gold mine, but personally I just can't see the merit in spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of our money and buying ourselves some bad publicity. So can you give us an update on where that's at? And also the related issue of the coronial inquiry into the Beaconsfield gold mine collapse. I understand the counsel for the coroner has been investigating a wide range of parties, and I'm presuming it would be correct to assume that a number of executives from the bank have been interviewed by counsel for the coroner on this question of did the bank control the mine at the time of the collapse, and I'm presuming your position is the same as it always has been, is that we had no control over the mine. Is that yeah. Give us an update on where we're at, and is that still your position?
Well, I think the answer is that there's been no progress insofar as it affects us since we last discussed this matter. It is, our policy is that it would be inappropriate to comment on a matter that's before a judicial process, and that refers to the two judicial processes that we're still waiting, I believe, for a judgment in the defamation case.
That's right, David.
We haven't got a judgment yet. And our position, as what we've said previously, remains, and that's we're a creditor, not a shareholder in the Allstate operation, and we had no involvement in the operation of the mine.
Jill?
Chairman, I'd like to support most of what you've just said. That $80 million figure in the Herald was a disgrace, lumping in shares and all sorts of other things. The true story for Alan Moss last year was he suffered the biggest pay cut in the history of Australia. His pay went from $33.5 million to $24.7 million. He suffered a $9 million pay cut. Now, it's not a case of where's the soup kitchen, but it wasn't a case of $80 million. That was just completely concocted. I'd like to congratulate Macquarie for what they've done with their remuneration policy in listening to the relatively large protests that came from their shareholders last year. Shareholders will probably remember that Risk Metrics, the big proxy advisor, took on Macquarie last year, recommended against the remuneration report on the basis that too much of the pay was in short-term bonuses. And I think it's a fair argument. Nicholas has taken up more than $100 million in cash, short-term bonuses, over the last 5 years. Alan Moss up at those levels. When you've received that much in cash, in short-term bonuses, where, arguably, where's the care factor over the longer term? So I think that the criticism was right. You waged a fairly aggressive lobbying campaign against the Risk Metrics report last year. Subsequent to seeing the vote of 21.5% against the remuneration report and further consultations, you saw the light. And Nicholas, to his credit, has agreed to a new payment system where a much bigger share of the bonus pool is in the form of shares. And I think today we'll see the proxies coming in the high 90s, where they should be. The Macquarie model has been very successful over a long time. This is the biggest change we've ever seen to the Macquarie model. You haven't been too inflexible or too proud. You tried to stare down your shareholders and then you've seen the light. So well done on that, and you deserve to get the very large support that the instos will give you today. A couple of minor points to quibble over. The Centro collapse highlighted the issue around companies lending their executives money to hold shares in the company. Now, Chairman, you've got a $35 million loan from Macquarie. Nicholas is at $12.25 million. I think we'd all prefer to see those sort of loans. I think, Chairman, your loan's probably the biggest loan outstanding to any board member in the country from any company. So can you introduce a program where that liability might be extinguished in the relatively near future? I'd also like to ask why on earth Andrew Downes' pay fell from $21.5 million to $14.9 million when he's the head of Treasury, and Treasury produced a staggeringly impressive $992 million net trading income figure for the last half, which was a record. So when there's a global credit crisis going on, the boffins at Macquarie have come out with the biggest net trading performance ever. That was a sensational performance, but your Treasury boss has copped a 25% haircut in his pay. I just don't understand how that works. And finally, I'd like to say that your NEDs, your non-executive directors, are paid probably more than most, but I think the likes of Catherine Livingston getting $330,000 a year is utterly justified. Australian NEDs aren't paid enough relative to what executives get. You can't have a millionaire's factory with blokes getting $30 million and then have NEDs struggling along on $150 to $200. So I think that you're slightly above market on what you pay your NEDs. I think that's completely justifiable based on the terrific performance we've seen, the high calibre board we've got. Someone told me that Catherine has to meet once a week as chairman of the audit committee and reviews transaction by transaction. That's a very big workload. And the only director on this board who's overcommitted is Kevin McCann. I think, Kevin, you know, you're chairman of two other big companies. I think you probably are overloaded. Everyone else is not overloaded and are getting paid properly and therefore can devote maybe a couple of days a week to Macquarie. That contributes to the performance we've got. So overall on pay, very happy with the change. Don't think anyone's getting an unreasonable amount. And we all want to see Nicholas getting bonuses of $50 million a year into the future because the stock price will be back up towards $100 if that's the case. Thanks.
Thank you, Stephen. Can I make just a couple of comments? First of all, the only way that I can judge whether a non-executive director is too heavily loaded is whether he or she performs at the board meeting. Kevin's attendance and his level of preparation is impeccable, and there is no evidence whatsoever that he's in any way overloaded insofar as fulfilling his duties at Macquarie Bank, which are quite onerous in that he's chair of the Corporate Governance Committee, a member of the Audit Committee, and so it's a pretty heavy workload at Macquarie, and he fulfills that role with distinction and without any suggestion of any overload. I think it should be noted that some people are capable of carrying heavy workloads, and Kevin obviously appears to be one of those. Thank you for your comments on non-executive director remuneration generally. I basically agree with what you say. In relation to Andrew, I'm simply not prepared to enter a discussion of individual remuneration. It's a complex issue, and that's about all I want to say on that. In relation to my loan, if you would like to follow the disclosures I've made to the Stock Exchange regularly about options and collars and loans that go with that, you'll see that the bank has watertight security in relation to, it's on normal commercial terms, and it's related to that. The alternative, frankly, would have been to sell the shares, which I would prefer not to have done. So, and I think I've commented on this in previous years, and nothing much has changed, although I think during the year I did liquidate some shares, and that's, the loan has been reduced accordingly. I think that's the various points that you raise.
You need to vote for Nicholas today. Why has Nicholas chosen to take on the exemption where CEOs can choose not to be elected, but the majority usually put themselves up? I think it's best practice. If you are a director, you put yourself up. You have a lot more moral authority if you've been elected, not appointed. So why do we choose exemption? And I just encourage Nicholas next year to put himself up next year, because I really want to vote for Nicholas. His magazine will be able to run the headline, Nicholas re-elected with 99% in favour. He's under no threat, so I'd invite him to do that next year, if that's all right.
Look, I think we're doing nothing more than continuing the practice when Mr. Moss was the managing director. I'd take issue that most companies do re-elect the managing director. I think the overwhelming majority don't. And I don't see that we're likely to change the practice of the last 20 years.
And on Helen, that's quite interesting what you said about Helen's name coming out of the hat. I actually had a theory about why, one of the reasons why you had changed your remuneration policy was that if you hadn't changed your remuneration policy, Helen, as chairman of the Remuneration Committee, would have got a substantial protest vote against her election. And I was simply going to make the observation that I'm glad she will be re-elected with high 90s, because as REM committee chair, she's seen the light and made the change. Now, Helen's been on the board for 9 years. My wife's the director of the RACV. As soon as she got on the board, she had to sign a thing saying she'd quit after 12 years. 12 years was the maximum, and it's a big, you know, $2 billion mutual. So is it fair to assume that Helen will serve a full term, she'll get to 12 years, and then she's likely to retire, or does Macquarie have a view that there's no tenure limits, and if she's young and fit and strong and doing well, she can go on for an indefinite period?
We do have some tenure rules, but service prior to the date we introduced them, which I can't remember offhand, is weighted 50%. So I'm not quite sure of the precise date of the... Do you know those? No. I mean, and I think the whole issue of tenure rules is something we may choose to re-examine, but at the moment there are some tenure rules, but service prior to, I've forgotten the year, is only weighted for 50%, which was a transition arrangement.
Just a preliminary, Chairman, you're adopting an unusual practice of not disclosing the proxies as we go along. I'd just like to, with your agreement, when you do flash up all the proxies at the end, if there are any surprise protest votes against any resolutions, I'd just like to potentially have the opportunity to discuss that, if that's happened. I'm not comfortable with a meeting which is run where we close the meeting, then you show us the proxy results, something's happened with the instos, and we don't even get a chance as a meeting to discuss it. Now, normally you would have a discussion about a resolution and then you'd put the proxies up. So we would have seen the proxies for the remuneration report by now, we'd have seen them for Helen, and I'm uncomfortable with this flash them at the end and no chats thing. So if there is any surprise things, will you leave open the opportunity to discuss that after you reveal the proxies?
Well, I would disagree with you about what is best practice, but can I say I think there's not much point in arguing about an academic outcome.
So everything's done well today. Okay, that's good. On Mr. Kirby, I think it's great, not only for Macquarie but for Australia, that CSR headhunted guy from England. He came here, did a great job. As a Rinka shareholder, we all made a fortune, courtesy of the Mexican takeover. And then he stayed in the country, and he's serving on boards. And he's a high-calibre international executive. So I think it's terrific that we've got him for the country and that we've kept him for Macquarie. My only query goes to the fact that Orica, I think, was a major client of ours. We did the Dyno deal together, and I think Dyno we made $300 or $400 million in the end. It was one of our best ever deals. And Peter's on the Orica board, and they seem to have run off into the hands of Goldman Sachs' J.B. Weir for this demerger. So I'm curious as to whether we've had a falling out with our own director and his board, or whether there was potentially some sort of conflict around the fact that we had a big involvement in the Dyno Intertek deal and couldn't be involved in other companies in the space. Because you look at Helen and Kevin, both on the Origin board. We're defending Origin from the BG Raiders, so as you'd hope and as you'd expect. But we don't seem to have a gig with Orica, which is unusual given the cross-directorship. So what's the situation there?
Stephen, you know we can't comment on client-related matters, so I think I'll note the question, and if you want to take it up with Peter afterwards, by all means, feel free.
Chairman, it's good to see Nicholas has plenty of skin in the game. He's got more than a million fully paid shares worth 50 mil. At the current price, is only $12 million loan from the bank, so he's got plenty of equity. He's currently got 532,000 existing options. I'm interested in if you can just give us a context as to what the average strike price is on that. Be useful to know as to whether he's underwater or in the money in terms of his options to buy another $25 million worth of stock, which is what that amounts to at current market prices. And does his contract provide for this to happen every year? Are we going to see a similar amount of options at market prices, you know, $10 million worth of options every year? Is that in his contract, or is this a one-off options issue at the beginning of his contract? Because I know we've seen options issues every year with Mr. Moss over the years. Is that something we're going to see going forward? Because Nicholas obviously has a very big equity play at the moment, and whether he necessarily needs to finish up with a $200 million equity play at the end of 3 or 4 years, you know, sometimes these things can get a bit too big.
Thank you for that question, Stephen. I'll leave it to Nicholas to choose whether he wants to answer the first bit or not. But in relation to the second bit, the system of awarding options was changed some, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, from kind of a large grant and then nothing for the next 4 or 5 years to a system where there would be annual grants. So, I mean, it's not in anyone's contract. The remuneration arrangements are the only thing that's in the contract basically is 30 days' notice either way. And that's true with all our employees, basically. But it is practice for there to be annual grants and subject to performance. I would expect that would continue. And the annual grant is sort of has to be managed within an overall cap of 20% of the equity being available. That was disclosed in the original offering memorandum in 1985 and hasn't changed since then.
Do you want... Sure. Thank you, David. Stephen, in the annual report, I think on Greg's just passed to me on page 105, you'll have details of the options that I've received over the last couple of years. And Greg tells me if you look at the prior annual reports, you'll see the grants that predate that. So you'll see the amount of shares and you'll see the prices that they've been issued at.